You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, on this lovely January Friday, and with me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
You don't suppose it's January thaw already, do you?
Well, if it gets up to 60, then I'll be counting.
Okay, that's a tradition. Tradition in Iowa is January thaw.
And then
it hits you with a blast after that.
Oh, well, you know, it could change.
Be
different.
Yeah, could.
So what have you been reading this week, Mom?
Well, this week I've been reading My Stroke of Insight, and it's wonderful. It's some of it's technical, but this woman is a brain scientist, so of course it's, you know. But the fact that she was able to recover and remember what happened and how she felt and what her reactions were to people around her as she was in stroke is marvelous. It just is. I have a friend whose wife died of stroke, and she was not with it for several days before she died. But I told him, I said, I bet she knew you were there.
Well, our guest today is the author of My Stroke of Insight, Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor. Dr. Taylor is a neuroanatomist who is affiliated with the Indiana University School of Medicine in Indianapolis. She's the national spokesperson for the mentally ill at the Harvard Brain Tissue Resource Center, also known as the Brain Bank, and the consulting neuroanatomist for the Midwest Proton Radiotherapy Institute. And since 1993, she's been an active member of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. She was named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People in the World for 2008, and I can certainly understand why.
So can I.
Welcome to Writers' Voices, Dr. Taylor.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I appreciate it.
So tell us, most of our listeners are probably somewhat familiar with you because you have gotten some publicity in this past year. But for those who aren't, why don't you give us a brief summary of what your book's about?
Well, I grew up to study the brain because I have a brother who's been diagnosed with a brain disorder, schizophrenia, and he's only 18 months older than I am, so he was my constant companion. He was everywhere I went, everything I learned. He was pretty much my introduction to the world. And I noticed at an early age that he was really very different from me in the way he chose to behave based on information that we were both given. And so I became aware that he was very different, and he was eventually diagnosed with schizophrenia. So I grew up to be a brain scientist because I really was desperate to understand what is normal, what is how does our brain create our perception of reality, and how is it that two of us can have the exact same experience but walk away with totally different perspectives about what just happened. So I grew up to be a neuroanatomist, and I was teaching and performing research at Harvard Medical School. My area of investigation, of course, is schizophrenia, the postmortem investigation. So I actually looked at the brains of individuals who had various different illnesses, psychiatric illnesses, and compared the brain tissue to normal control. And it was I was having a wonderful time. I was serving on the National Board of Directors for NAMI, the National Alliance for Mental Illness. And you actually have a very strong NAMI in Iowa. And I just woke up one day, and I had a severe hemorrhage in the left hemisphere of my brain. And through the eyes of a scientist, I got to watch my mind completely deteriorate in its ability to process information. And on the morning of the stroke, I could not walk, talk, read, write, and I had no recollection of my life. So I essentially became completely disabled and was an infant in a woman's body.
And how old were you at that point?
I was 37 years old when that happened. And then the next 8 years, I had to undergo major craniotomy and have a blood clot the size of a golf ball removed from that left hemisphere. And then it took me 8 years to recover. And the book, My Stroke of Insight, is a documentation of taking you on the morning of the stroke through the eyes of a scientist, step by step as my brain deteriorates, and then through the process of recovery. And then it's called My Stroke of Insight because really to me the most important thing is what did I learn? What did I learn about my own brain and how to interact with my brain in order to get it to do what I want it to do because I had this this incredible opportunity to lose half of my mind. it's been a wild ride. It's been a really very interesting and growthful experience for me.
Well, I know at first you said, there's no way you're going to open up my head, and you didn't want to do that that brain surgery.
Yeah, no, no respecting neuroanatomist would ever let anybody ever open up their head. But I really didn't have any choice in order to get that tissue out so that the swelling could go down and the brain could actually go back to as normal function and essentially reset itself for learning.
Wasn't it wonderful that your mother was able to come and care for you and understood that your healing process demanded some things that weren't all by the book? For instance, that
my greatest blessing was having my mother as my mother and to have her come into my life. And she realized right from the beginning that she describes me as a warm body, a breathing body in the bed.
Uh-huh.
Body and bed. Mm-hmm. There was nothing else there. I didn't have any recognition of any of my life. I couldn't make any sense out of the external world. I was just really completely detached from any normal reality. And she just came back into my world, and we began as an infant and a mother again. She just got into bed and started rocking me. And that was the new beginning, and that was exactly what I needed. And her intuition, you know, everybody asks her, you know, how did you know what to do? And she said she just paid attention. She just did what came naturally next. And so she didn't have a plan, and she didn't necessarily follow traditional, conventional plan.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was some of those deviations from traditional care that really gave me the advantage to be able to recover completely again.
Well, Dr. Taylor, you allude in your book to the fact that, you know, your mother wasn't able to heal your brother's brain illness,
right,
despite what she could, you know, despite any efforts she made. And so this gave her another shot at doing that, and this time she was successful.
Right. Wow. Yeah, my brother had been living with her for a decade as an adult living at home again, and you know, for her it was just so frustrating that she could not really fix him. She couldn't, no matter what she did. She could protect him. She could feed him and keep a roof over him and provide medication for him, but she really didn't feel that she could really rehabilitate him, which of course you cannot do with the severe mental illnesses. You can definitely help people. You can increase quality of life. You can certainly provide them with access to treatment, but you can't cure them, if you will. And so when I came down with a different neurological problem, a different brain disorder, she had 10 years of pent-up frustration of not being able to fix my brother, and really just threw herself wholeheartedly into, I'm going to fix this child. Maybe I can help. Yeah. So, and she did. She did really a beautiful job.
And do you feel like that there's a possibility from some of the things that you learned from this experience and from the things you're learning in your research that maybe someday people with severe mental illness will be able to retrain other parts of their brain, other neurons, to do the things so that they can have a more normal reality?
I don't think there's any question that that's what's happening. We find that individuals who take an active interest in their own care, where they're willing to pay attention to how well are they doing, and if they're not doing well, to work hand-in-hand with their caseworkers and their physicians to tweak their medication so that the meds end up doing more help than harm. Many individuals hate their meds because these are very, very powerful drugs in the brain. So working with a psychiatrist in order to get the right med combination. But again, the individual has to be willing to take some responsibility for their own recovery. They have to pay attention to how much sleep are they allowing themselves, how much sugar and caffeine are they pumping into their bodies, how much talk therapy are they willing to go through, how willing are they to participate in their own care. And individuals who do take an active role in participating in their own care do better.
In your book, you mentioned that trying was like a major part of your recovery, was just trying and trying and trying again.
Yeah, the willingness to try. I was in such a disconnected state of being that was I willing in this moment to do what I had to do, which may mean pain for me, in order to just something as simple as pay attention to you when you speak. Because when I had lost language, I lost that ability to really understand quickly. So I had to work real hard to pick your voice out of the background noise. I had to look at the shape of your lips as you made different sounds and try to put all that information together in order to understand what words were you speaking, and then what were the meanings of those words. So just trying, whether it's a cognitive ability or a paralysis or a weakness of a limb, I had to take the initiative and be willing to try. And if I tried, and I tried 1,000 times a day, then maybe I would get something back down the road. But if I wasn't willing to try, then I think I really cut down on the possibility that I ever would be able to regain that function.
Well, you had pointed out that if you were in a traditional rehab situation, you might not be allowed to sleep as much as you needed, and you would be be stimulated beyond what you could handle. And is that a common thing, you think, for people who are in?
I think it is in a lot of environments. Rehabilitation institutions do things very differently. Nursing homes do things very differently. But oftentimes, individuals who are stroke survivors who are in a facility may be awakened very early in the morning, have amphetamines put into them in order to wake them up, to their brain up to as alert a state as possible. They may then be propped up in a wheelchair and rolled out into a social environment where they're blaring TVs or other forms of stimulation, and that was exactly not what I wanted. I wanted silence. I wanted peace and quiet. I was on total overstimulation and overload, mm-hmm. and my brain needed to go to sleep and file away and reorganize all the information that it had. So I was very fortunate that I was not placed into some type of an institution, but instead had very specialized care.
Well, they keep telling us that we all need more sleep than we probably get to rehabilitate ourselves, and I believe that. I really do.
Dr. Taylor, do you think by coming public with your story that you'll have an impact on changing how some of these institutions treat stroke survivors?
Well, and I appreciate you calling them survivors instead of victims, because I'm a firm believer that anyone who has survived a stroke is definitely a survivor.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a big difference in how we treat people if we look at them as a stroke victim or if we look at them as a stroke survivor, and I think that they feel that energy. But yes, it's already making some change. It's very interesting. The book's only been out in the world about 6 months. In the big market, and I get literally hundreds of emails every day from people who are reading the book, and it's beautiful for me when I get the messages from the professionals, the speech pathologists, the people involved in rehab, the RNs, the nurses, who are saying, you have changed the way I look at a stroke survivor.
Mm-hmm.
And because I look at them differently now, I treat them differently. Thank you for the insight. And to me, you know, I just well up with all this emotion. Because it's so beautiful. And to be able to influence the system by influencing the individuals is the first step. And the book is now starting to go out into the academic market and different kinds of professional schools are using it, starting to use it as required reading. And as soon as that happens, then more and more of the upcoming professionals will have a different perspective, how to look at these individuals and about how to treat them. And then systemic change is always the last to happen. But I have faith down the road. Let's talk again in 5 years and see what they're doing.
Good idea.
Okay. Well, I was in the hospital the other day just visiting with someone in the lobby, and I had this book and in my under my arm, and two different people commented they had read it and that how wonderful it was. So I thought, boy, that's great.
Yeah, it's really, they call it entrenched. Now, I guess, is an official term of it has made it into the populations of people who will use it regularly. And so I'm thrilled. I couldn't be happier that the book has made it into the population so that it can actually get into the hands of the people who are desperate for that information. You know, as soon as someone has a stroke, there is now a book on the market where you can get an idea of what do I do now? What is going on with my loved one? How freaked out should I be? What should I be doing? How do I help this person from day one? And there hasn't been anything like that available.
Right. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, author of My Stroke of Insight. Dr. Taylor, your book is much more than just a memoir of illness. It's also a description from an expert on the causes of stroke and methods of rehabilitation with deep spiritual and philosophical overtones. Did combining all these genres in a way that hadn't been done before make it easier or more difficult to get your book published?
Well, actually, I'm an unusual case. I gave a presentation at a organization called TED, Technology, Entertainment, and Design, and that was last February. And I gave a presentation to them, and it was an enormous hit at that conference, and they had tape recorded it, and they put it on the internet about 10 days later. And once that 18-minute video hit the internet, it spread like wildfire, and millions of people had seen it within the first month. So once that happened, Oprah found out about it, and Oprah interviewed me on her Soul series, on her XM radio program. And the publishers all found out that about this video, and then they realized that I had self-published a book a year and a half prior to that. And so all the publishers at that point found me very attractive.
I bet. Well, how did you – I have a couple questions from that. One is, how did you choose which publisher to go with?
Well, it was that was an interesting process. I believed in the longevity of the book, and so I was more interested in a deal that was going to reap better for me financially in the long term rather than in the short term. And so, and that was important because, you know, different publishers do things differently. But I'm a firm believer that if you really believe in the longevity and the message of the book, then it'll be around for a long time. So protect yourself down the road. At the same time, everybody's saying, "Oh no, take whatever funds come up front. Take the you know, a bigger
take the
deal.
Big advance." Yeah.
So, yeah, and but you really have to weigh what you believe is true about your book. And you know, 700,000 people a year in the United States alone have a stroke.
Oh my gosh.
That's a new market every year, as far as I'm concerned.
That's right.
700,000 new people who need that book, and that's just from the stroke population. That's not counting any other type of neurological trauma, or the people who are really falling in love with the book because it's this bridge between science and spirituality.
Well, did you make any changes from your original self-published book to the one that was published by Viking?
I think we changed 5 words.
Wow, that's not bad.
Well, we were kind of in a hurry. They were in a hurry. One group, one of the ways that I chose the publisher also was in their plan of attack. And the publisher that I went with was Penguin Viking, and their plan was to literally, this is the wildest story probably in the business. We signed a contract. I signed a contract with them on Thursday, May 8th, and they had that day, and the next day they printed 270,000 copies of the book, and they had it in stores by Monday.
Oh, my goodness.
Side of the Mississippi, and by Wednesday on your side of the Mississippi, because Monday night was the first airing of my interview with Oprah on the website.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
So they didn't have any time to change anything.
I guess not.
I don't think they needed to.
No. that was kind of important to me because my biggest concern was if I went with a major publisher, that I didn't want them to take away the authenticity of the voice.
Right.
And, you know, so I didn't have to deal with any of that.
Now, when you originally published your book, you said you self-published. Did you work with an editor at all, or was it just you?
I did not work with a real editor. I worked with my mom and friends. And my mom's pretty good with grammar, et cetera. I mean, she's just drilled me my whole life. So this was her kind of project. And then once I got it past mom, I distributed it to friends and said, you know, give me feedback, positive, negative, anything at all, just give me feedback. And so I had about 15 friends who did that.
And how as a writer and asking for feedback from friends, sometimes you get really good really productive feedback, and sometimes you get things that are really not very useful and maybe even discouraging. Did that ever happen to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Most of the people took care of little things. You know, the hardest thing for me to write this book was that writing a book is an enormous concept. It's an enormous project. It has linearity. And my brain didn't really have linearity very well established in it because when I lost the left hemisphere, I lost my ability to think linearly. So when I wrote the book, I wrote, there's a famous book called Bird by Bird. Are you familiar with that book?
Yeah, Annie Lamott. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I that book gave me what I needed because it said, sit down and write a story. Write about this. Just don't worry about anything else. Just write the piece. And so I would write these little page-long pieces that were very specific. And then later I would go back and add linearity to that and string them together and then eventually the hard part was finding which voice, you know, what voice am I communicating with? And there wasn't any question that it just had to come from my heart because this whole stroke took me straight into my heart consciousness. And so I just had to share my story. And so this is a brain scientist's personal journey. I mean, I totally own it as my own experience. And it's totally from my perspective as a professional and as an individual. And, you know, it's just a journey. So this is one woman's journey and what I learned. And it was interesting because there was actually another section, the first part, actually, of the book, which was pre-stroke. So that you had a better idea of who I was pre-stroke. And that section was about, I'm going to say, 40 pages long. And a friend of mine read it, and he said, Jill, you know, it's just not going to fly. And I said, well, okay, why not? And he said, well, because I want more. I want to know more about you. And I said, thank you. And I threw that section out of the book and said, the book is done.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because the book, that missed the point. Mm. I didn't want who I was to be the distraction. Professional.
Yeah.
She had this experience. Who I was before was extra information that really was not significant. And so to me, every day when I wrote, I always asked myself the question, what's the point? What is the point? And to try to pull it as quick to the point as I possibly could, because I've never been a big reader. I read scholastic stuff. I live technical stuff, all my academic books. I love that. But I've never been a big reader outside of that because I didn't have time for it. And I'm a very slow reader. So if I need a book to be, my limit, I should probably not admit this on your program, 220 pages. If I can't read what you want me to tell me in 220 pages, I give up.
Yeah,
I agree. I'm part of that population.
I love when you said...
It's my goal to have this book be under 220 pages.
You said at one point, you asked, could I rejoin the rat race without becoming a rat again?
Right. Yeah.
Now, Dr. Taylor, did writing... you started this writing process pretty early while you were still recovering. Did it aid in the recovery process, the fact that you were writing?
Well, I wrote in the first year, and between the first and second year post-stroke, I wrote The Morning of the Stroke. And you have to remember that this now was written by a woman who didn't have any language a year and a half before that. So my vocabulary was not expansive. My fluidity, my sentences were very short. I didn't have the bigger picture. I had to do it early, though, in order, before I forgot it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know, as the brain recovered, my perspective would change, and I would become more and more detached from the place that I had gone. So I had to write that as early on as I possibly could. But once The Morning of the Stroke was written, then I had to figure out how am I going to pay my bills again. And I had to relearn my science, and I had to go back to teaching. And so I started taking small jobs here and there in order to pay my bills. And you know, the funny thing about recovery is you cannot write about recovery until you have recovered, because you don't have anything to write about.
Right.
So... Now, my mother wanted me to you know, do this and get it done and move on and do other things, and I just kept saying to her, you know, the book will happen when the book is supposed to happen. And that section could not be written until I was completely recovered, and that was at the eight-year mark. And so I spent the eighth year and the ninth year finishing the book, writing the recovery section and then the My Stroke of Insight section at the end.
Now, when you were writing about The Morning of the Stroke, you were having to sort of revisit all what happened to you and really think about what happened to you. Were you at all concerned that focusing your attention on that would, probably a pretty painful experience, might reinforce that experience in your brain?
Well, actually, yes. And actually, I wanted it to be reinforced, because I didn't want to forget it.
Mm.
I gained so much in during the process. I shifted completely from a very high-powered job, brain scientist, left hemisphere thinking, critically analyzing, just a real left hemisphere brain, into someone who experienced their relationship with the external world as being at one with all that is. I mean, I completely shifted, and I didn't want to forget that. And it was part of my agreement with myself that I would recover up to the point where I was not willing to sacrifice the new insight, the new perception that I had gained. So it was an extremely I don't want to say painful, because I really don't see the process as painful, but it was totally experiential, and I had to go back and relive it. I had to go back to the morning. I had to go back to all of the emotions and all of the thoughts and all of the smells and all of the everything in order to feel it, in order to take you on that ride with me. It was a very challenging experience, but it was a very positive experience for me.
Well, Dr. Taylor, did you, in trying to retain what you had gained from your right brain kind of coming online more, you say you didn't, that you only wanted to recover up to the point where you could still retain that. Do you think that limited your, keeping, having your right brain that enlivened, does that limit your left brain? in some way?
I don't think it limits it. I think that, but I did consciously limit my left brain. There were certain parts of my left hemisphere that I really did not want to give new life back to. In moving language, I lost my identity. You know, and did you ever wonder how it is that you know who you are? You know who you are because your brain is constantly giving you information about yourself. This is your name. This is your address. This is your phone number. These are the details of your life. These are your likes and your dislikes. Your brain is constantly reminding you of that information. If it should go offline and that part doesn't exist for you anymore, then you're still you. You're just very different than that other person who your brain had defined you as. So then it all starts getting very interesting, because then was I really that same person whom I had been before, even though I didn't have any of the memories of her life and I didn't have any of her likes or dislikes? So part of that language was, for example, the worrier. Well, when worry came back into my life and that circuit came back online, I didn't like the way that it felt. So I decided, no, I wasn't going to run that circuitry anymore. I wasn't going to think the thoughts that made me feel that, and I was going to change now who I'm going to be by choice. And I think that was probably one of the most profound things that I learned, was that we have so much more say over who we are and how we perceive ourselves and what we allow to go on inside of our heads than anybody ever taught us.
You're listening to KRUU-FM in Fairfield, Iowa, and our guest today on Writer's Voices is Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, author of My Stroke of Insight. And we're really getting into some interesting information here, aren't we, Mom?
Yes, we are. You know, about the right brain, left brain thing, you say that you feel that the right brain has been maligned in the past, and now you realize that there's quite a bit there that can be developed and so forth. I thought that was interesting.
Well, I think that, you know, when you look at the brain just scientifically, it's obvious that the brain's divided into two halves, and each of those halves, you can live with just one half and have the other half go be taken away if you had some severe type of disorder, like a severe epilepsy, and they needed to either cut the connections between the two halves or to remove part of your brain. And people can be a whole human being and just have half a brain.
So saying somebody has half a brain isn't necessarily an insult.
No. Well, I'm not going to touch that one. Okay, Monica.
Okay.
Well, when you said that the right hemisphere, yeah, consciousness.
I think it depends on which half is probably going on. Right.
Okay. Yeah. When you're talking.
But really what I learned was, you know, I have these two very different characters, these two very different brains inside of my head that work totally different from one another. And they look at the world totally differently. And my right hemisphere looks at the big picture, and it processes information in pictures, and it's looking at the collective whole. It thinks holistically, and it's very kind and very joyful. It's the present moment experience. And then my left hemisphere, which is thinks linearly in language, it defines my life and me. So it's very detail-based. It's all about the details of my job and of my interactions with the external world. And so it's just very different. And I think that the key is that we have these two inside of our heads, and that we have choice in how we are in any situation. And with any kind of situation, I can choose to interact with the world through that kindness, that compassionate, loving piece of me, or through that more critically analyzing, judgmental piece of me. And I think we all have that ability.
I mean, we just don't think about it. We just kind of go along. And
Most of us just react.
Uh-huh.
We react to the world coming at us, and how I react is how I react. But, you know, you don't have to react like that. You're making choices, whether you're doing it consciously or unconsciously. You have choices, and you're making choices.
Explain about that, how the artery is connected to the vein through the capillaries, and then in your case, that's what happened, was a breakdown of that connection and caused the clot there?
Right. Normally, the arteries, as they taper away from the brain, get smaller and smaller, and then there is, when it gets down to such a small diameter that single red blood cells can just pass, that right at that level is a capillary.
Uh-huh.
And then at the other end of that is a low-pressure system, the vein, and the vein essentially absorbs fluid out of the body by osmosis, because there's particulate matter inside. I'm probably getting too scientific here. It's essentially a varicose vein in the brain.
Ah.
And I had one of those because I had an artery directly connected to a vein without that capillary network in between.
Ah.
So it was essentially a bomb ready to blow in my brain. And,
uh-huh.
and it's an arteriovenous malformation, or AVM, and they typically blow between the ages of 25 and 45.
And if you had known you had this, was there anything you could have done to prevent it blowing?
Yeah, I could have had voluntary brain surgery,
which you probably wouldn't have been too willing to do.
I'm really glad I didn't know about it. That would have been a really tough decision. I mean, it was hard enough having already experienced the stroke, much less, it might.
Yeah.
That would have been a tough call.
Right. Now, Dr. Taylor, in the first part of the book, when you're writing about the morning of the stroke, you describe an experience which seems to correspond to what the Transcendental Meditation Movement, which is based here in Fairfield, refers to as witnessing, or observing your own actions as if from outside of yourself. And this is considered by many people to be a sign of expanded consciousness. Do you still ever have that experience?
Yeah, I do. I often will look at my limbs, look at my arm, or look at my leg and just be observing them rather than recognizing that that's my leg, and I wiggle my toes through that. I really feel very blessed because in the absence of normal function of my left hemisphere, when I shifted into this right hemisphere consciousness, there were no boundaries. I could not define the boundaries of my body, which meant I felt that I was as big and expansive as the universe. I was atoms and molecules connected to the atoms and molecules of everything around me. And I describe myself as feeling that I was a fluid, and I am a fluid. You are a fluid. You know, we're 80% water, lymphatics, blood. Things are moving around fluidly within us, between us, among us, atoms and molecules outside of us. And it takes a small group of cells in the left hemisphere to define that boundary of where I begin and where I end, so that I can look at my leg and say, well, that's my leg, and that's not my leg, the space beyond it. So that is something that I can routinely go back to that. I spent 5 weeks, 2.5 weeks before the stroke and then 2.5 weeks after the stroke, in a totally silent brain, which meant my brain, no brain chatter whatsoever, no little voice saying, oh, that's nice, or no, that's not nice, or oh, that's hot, or oh, that's cold, no conversation whatsoever, just experiential being. And it was beautiful. I sat around with this euphoric grin on my face, and my mother would look at me and just say, where are you? What is going on with you? How can you be so joyful in this condition, which was, she perceived simply as just so detached and so disabled.
Could you communicate with her at that point?
Not on any sophisticated level. Because I didn't have words, I didn't have vocabulary. I was really an infant. I could experience, I could perceive information, but I didn't organize it and structure it using language, which left me compelled to communicate in different ways. I kind of describe it like imagine that you speak English. Just English, and all of a sudden you find yourself out in China.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't understand a word anybody's saying, but you are picking up on facial expression, vocal tone, intonation, body language. You're still picking up a lot of information. You're on total alert. You're totally aware of your surroundings. You just can't speak to these people.
You haven't lost your intelligence.
Right, exactly. I haven't lost my intelligence, just the ability to use language to communicate.
Wow.
Well, it was interesting, too, that people need to make eye contact with a stroke survivor and, you know, touch them maybe gently and speak softly rather than assume that they're deaf and cannot hear well. So that's important.
I think that's one of the biggest mistakes that people make when they're around stroke survivors. If I don't understand you because I don't speak Chinese, you're yelling Chinese at me, I'm not going to...
That's not going to help.
No. Help any. I don't get it. And I need you to find another way to communicate with me. And one of the problems is if you are yelling at me, then I'm going to be like a puppy, and I'm going to get scared of you,
mm-hmm.
withdraw from you.
Mm-hmm.
And as my caregiver, the last thing you want me to do is to be afraid of you, because I certainly won't learn in that environment.
Right.
Now, Dr. Taylor, when you were in this state of expanded consciousness and a lot of bliss, was it tempting to just stay there and not try and get your left brain back online?
It was very tempting to just stay there. It was, it was total euphoria. It was bliss for me. And I had to consciously make the decision that I was willing to recover. So it was a decision for me to try. And once I made the decision that I would try to recover, then I was full speed ahead, and everything I did was committed to me trying. I had to change my perception from why do I have to go back, why do I have to recover, to why did I get to have this experience? What gift is there? What pearl is there for me who had the history I had and the experience and the education I had to be able to come to this place of silence inside of my mind, to be able to lose my left hemisphere, no guarantee I'd ever get any abilities back? What was the gift? And I realized that I had found deep inner peace. I had lost my left hemisphere, and somewhere in the circuitry of my right mind was this incredible, profoundly magnificent and beautiful euphoria and deep inner peace. And I thought, you know, if everyone knew that they themselves are wired for this kind of peaceful, blissful, euphoric experience right there in the right hemisphere, and it's always turned on and it's always available, and all you have to do is quiet your left hemisphere language center that's talking to you all the time and distracting you away from the present moment. If people knew that and they engaged with that part of themselves, then what a more peaceful and blissful and joyful place our world would be.
Now, that's what a lot of meditators are trying to do. You know, that's the meditative technique is designed to help still that brain chatter so that you can access that right brain.
Exactly.
Did you have any experience with meditation before, or prayer? Yes. Did you have any experience with any of those techniques prior to your stroke?
I tried to meditate when I was pre-stroke, but I was so analytical that I would just analyze to death my breath. So I was a very unsuccessful meditator, and I think a lot of people are very mm-hmm. unsuccessful because they're analyzing.
Right, right.
As soon as you tell me to think about my breath, well, I'm going to analyze that to death, analyze what is or isn't going on inside of my head, and that was not a technique that worked for me, put it that way.
Now, are you able now to access that place that in your right hemisphere, that experience, whenever you want?
Yeah, but for me, it's more like a switch. I'm here or I'm there.
Oh, interesting.
And because I know it, I know where I'm going. I think that's the advantage that I now have, is I know what it feels like. I know what it means to have an empty mind or to be absent of thought. It doesn't mean you've lost your intelligence. It doesn't mean you're dumb. It doesn't mean you're totally disconnected. It means you're tuned in to something other than all that stuff inside of your brain that is of any other time other than this present moment. And so for me, it's really easy for me to snap myself right into the present moment. And I do it all the time because I find life to be very interesting, very challenging, very, you know, people are fascinating creatures. And, you know, some of them are very angry. And when someone brings their angry energy to me, I have, and like we all do, we have mirror neurons that are designed for me to feel and empathize what you're experiencing. And there's a lot of stuff going on in the world that I don't want to feel that.
Mm-hmm.
I want to choose what I feel, and I want to choose my own peace rather than someone else's stress and anxiety.
Right.
So yes, I go to that space all the time. I go to that space when I choose to go there. So it's interesting because for me, the easiest way for me to recognize when I'm going to go there is when I feel my conscious mind start accelerating in the speed at which it thinks. And we all think at different speeds, but as soon as I feel my heart start pumping and I feel my mind start rushing and I'm searching for answers, and I feel that. You can feel that. You know when you're like that.
Right.
And I start feeling that, I make the decision immediately, am I going to move into that circuitry, or am I going to back off from that and come back to the present moment and get away from it?
Hmm. Now, do you ever,
I think,
ever get tempted to just stay there in the present moment and not turn your left brain back on?
No, because you know, ultimately, I know that I'm going to be in that space or something comparable to that when I'm dead.
Right.
And,
right.
And I'm not dead right now. And my time to be here is precious little time, whether I get 5 minutes more or 50 more years. It's still precious little time in all of eternity. And so I'm going to celebrate it and enjoy it and be it for as long as I have it, and be as actively, consciously aware and engaged with my world, influencing it, being influenced by it, trying to help make this world a better place in my own little way while I'm here. And I'm going to do that with enthusiasm, and then when I'm gone, I'm gone, and I'm there, and I'm happy with that.
Wow. You said that the hardest thing of your recovery is learning to read, because you could read, but you for a while you couldn't comprehend, and that must have been very frustrating.
Yeah, I did not like reading at all.
But in your job, I mean, in your life, and your you had to read, you had to do that, and
To me, I was so far away from the concept of reading that my mother would say, you know, she'd draw an S, and she would say, this is an S, and it sounds like S. And I thought, you know, oh my God, that's a squiggle, and it doesn't make any sound at all.
Dr. Taylor, before we run out of time, speaking of reading, would you like to read our audience a section from your book?
Yeah, I think I'll start with, this is chapter 19 out of 20.
Okay.
And I'm going to this point because it's called Finding Your Deep Inner Peace. And I really think that this is the most important message for the general public. The stroke of insight has given me the priceless gift of knowing that deep inner peace is just a thought, feeling, away. To experience peace does not mean that your life is always blissful. It means that you are capable of tapping into a blissful state of mind amidst the normal chaos of a hectic life. I realize that for many of us, the distance between our thinking mind and our compassionate heart sometimes feels miles apart. Some of us traverse this distance on command. Others of us are so committed to our hopelessness and misery that the mere concept of a peaceful heart feels foreign and unsafe. Based upon my experience with losing my left mind, I wholeheartedly believe that the feeling of deep inner peace is neurological circuitry located in our right brain. This circuitry is constantly running and always available for us to hook into. The feeling of peace is something that happens in the present moment. It's not something that we bring with us from the past or project into the future. Step one to experiencing inner peace is the willingness to be present in the right here, right now. Would you like me to continue?
Yes, a few more minutes I think would be good.
Okay. Oops, let me put my glasses back on.
Okay.
More aware we are of when we run our loop of deep inner peace, the easier it is for us to purposely choose to hook into that circuitry. Some of us struggle in our attempts to recognize when we are running this circuitry, only because our minds are distracted by other thoughts. This makes sense since our Western society honors and rewards the skills of our doing left brain much more than our being right brain. Thus, if you have difficulty accessing the consciousness of your right mind circuitry, then it is probably because you have done a stupendous job learning exactly what you were taught while growing up. Congratulate yourselves for their successes, and as my good friend Dr. Kat Domingo proclaims, enlightenment is not a process of learning, it's a process of unlearning. Since both of our hemispheres work together to generate our perception of reality on a moment-by-moment basis, we are exercising our right mind all the time. Once you learn to recognize the subtle feelings and physiology running through your body when you are connected to the circuitry of the present moment, you can then train yourself to reactivate that circuitry on demand. I'm going to share with you a variety of ways I remind myself back into the consciousness and personality of my right here, right now, peaceful right brain. The first thing I do to experience my inner peace is to remember that I am a part of a greater structure, an eternal flow of energy and molecules from which I cannot be separated. Knowing that I am a part of the cosmic flow makes me feel innately safe and experience my life as heaven on earth. How can I feel vulnerable when I cannot be separated from the greater whole? My left mind thinks of me as a fragile individual capable of losing my life. My right mind realizes that the essence of my being has eternal life. Although I may lose these cells and my ability to perceive this three-dimensional world, my energy will merely absorb back into the tranquil sea of euphoria. Knowing this leaves me grateful for the time I have here, as well as enthusiastically committed to the well-being of the cells that constitute my life.
Thank you. That was Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor reading from My Stroke of Insight, A Brain Scientist's Personal Journey.
And you said that in the book you said that you had a lot of support from your friends and cards and letters and so forth, but you weren't able to communicate with them on a personal basis. It took too much energy, and your mother kind of ran interference for you, and that was probably a good thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I became so connected to the energy around me that I was energy and a part of the energy that was. And so depending on the kind of energy that people would bring to me, I was very sensitive. And really it boiled down to people either brought me energy or they took energy away from me.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's very important that people recognize and take responsibility for the energy you bring to someone who is in any kind of debilitated condition. I think it's important that we take responsibility for our energy all the time, but particularly when we're around individuals who are ill.
Well, Dr. Taylor, do you feel like you're completely recovered at this point?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I believe I was 100% at the eight-year mark.
Are there any, well, there obviously there are ways that you were forever changed by this experience. If you had, this is kind of a question out of left field maybe, but if you could go back in time and you had the choice, you knew what was going to happen and you could have had that surgery to prevent it, or you could have gone through this experience, which would you choose?
Oh, there's no question. I would choose to have it work out the way that it did.
Wow.
I have gained so much understanding about how the brain organizes information that I never would have gotten out of my academic training. And, I had such a scholastic, intellectual perspective of the brain and what, I could read the story. I could read these experiences, but to feel them and to experience it, it's just opened up my mind to the possibilities of what we are as human beings and this really magnificent organ. So I'm grateful, and I think that the research that I'm working on will go move forward in the world and really help other people who have neurological trauma rehabilitate themselves from the inside out because I had this experience. So I would I'd go back and have it again. I don't want to do it again.
No, of course not.
Well,
been there, I've done that. But
been there, done that. Yeah,
have the T-shirt.
I wish, but if I could have avoided it, no, I'm glad that in many ways I'm glad that it happened.
The appendixes that you have in your book, Appendix A and B, recommendations for recovery, and Appendix B, 40 Things I Needed the Most, are very enlightening. And this is something that everybody should have. Everybody should have this. I mean, it's really, you know, really something. Well, I highly recommend this book to anybody.
Thank you. Thank you. It's essentially somebody has a manual, a guide now of
exactly.
what to do to help somebody who has a brain trauma. And it's really not just about anybody with a brain trauma. It's really about how to take care of your brain, how to look at your brain, how to get your brain to do what you want it to do. And it's a beautiful thing, especially when it works well. It's a beautiful thing.
Well, Dr. Taylor, we're out of time, but congratulations on the success of your book, and thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Oh,
it's
my
been
goodness.
A huge pleasure, and we'll get the interview posted on the archives of our website so that people who didn't get a chance to listen today will get a chance to download and listen. And you can also listen to the rebroadcast this coming Monday morning at 8 a.m.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you, ladies, for inviting me. I really appreciate your time.
We enjoyed it immensely.
Oh, I would say.
Thank you. And now we will close with a quote from Mom.
Okay. Now, this quote I used before last year, but it's so apropos, I think. Friends are the pillars of your porch. Sometimes they hold you up. Sometimes they lean on you. Sometimes it's just enough to know that they are standing by. Goodbye.
See you next week on Writer's Voices.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.